By the time I was 5 years old, I got extremely fascinated by how plants grow and how crazy it is that you have a tiny seed, you put it in the soil, it grows into a beautiful plant.
Plant a legacy.
If you really want to discover what nature is like, go to the Amazon rainforest. So I got a deep impression of what a beautiful planet we have, how precious this planet is, and how much we actually should be caring about it and making sure we can protect those natural resources because it's not an ever-ending planet.
Plant a legacy.
I realized that I'm here on this planet to make sure that future generations can still live here.
Plant a legacy.
Who wouldn't like to live in a beautiful environment, and who isn't ready to actually pay more for that? As it's already proven that communities that have adequate greenery, which is not just a tree and grass, but actual high-value nature that even attracts wildlife to a certain degree, they sell for double the amount in many cases.
When the safe development. Real estate development, land to legacy.
Matthew Mahoy, welcome to Real Estate Development, Land to Legacy. You're passionate about the one thing most developers cut from the budget, the landscape. I mean, honestly, I've done it so many times. Somehow you've turned dirt, plants, and purpose into a global mission. I'm super excited about this conversation. Tell me this, did your love for plants start with some grand epiphany, or was it just hiding in the garden, or were you just hiding in the garden trying to dodge from your farm chores?
Eugene, thank you first for having me on the show. You're hitting it right on the nail there by saying what you said at the beginning, but for you to understand where I came from, I'll give you my backstory. So I grew up on a family farm. My brother and father are farmers, and I'm very proud of that because farmers are very important for society. And in fact, they're the backbone of society in many ways. But by the time I was 5 years old, I got extremely fascinated by how plants grow and how crazy it is that you have a tiny seed, you put it in the soil, it grows into a beautiful plant. In some cases, a tree that can far outlive our own lives. Like, just that idea was mind-blowing to me. And then by the time I was 6 years old, I said to my parents, I want to start gardening. In the beginning, they didn't allow me to do that, but eventually I persisted and I did that. And when I first started gardening, I had no clue what I was doing. I just bought a bunch of seeds and I started putting stuff together. And I completely failed at gardening. Like, I thought it was so easy, put seeds in the soil. But I imagine a six-year-old, I had everything prepared. I thought I had to do this. And I come back to my garden a couple of weeks later and it's completely overgrown by weeds that are head high, higher than myself as a young kid. And I was devastated. I didn't understand it. Like, why is nature not helping us? Why is nature not just doing what we want? And why am I telling you this story is like a little fast forward into the future. I studied a bachelor in garden design because I was always passionate about nature and doing something with gardens. I did that, but I didn't really feel like satisfied because I didn't just want to do garden designs. And then I went on, I did a master degree in landscape architecture in Germany. And then, Eugene, I did what people expected me to do, was to get a 9-to-5. And I got into an office job in Munich where I had studied. I worked in two companies, really high ranked. We were doing really cool big scale projects also in development, but I was kind of trapped in this 9-to-5. It was very bureaucratic. And I said, I can't do this. So I quit my job and had some money saved up. And I started traveling the world because I knew there were people that were doing amazing stuff in both things that are good for the environment and that are good for business. So I went to visit a lot of eco projects. I went to regenerative farms, organic farms. I volunteered on eco projects. I went to eco resorts. I really dissected everything that was happening. And I was also living a really good life. I had a freelance job on my laptop. I was working remotely, traveling the world. And then Eugene, did something that I will never forget. It was a pivotal moment in my life. I went to the Amazon rainforest. If you really want to discover what nature is like, go to the Amazon rainforest. So I got a deep impression of what a beautiful planet we have, how precious this planet is, and how much we actually should be caring about it and making sure we can protect those natural resources because it's not an ever-ending planet. We can't just keep using it as if it's something disposable. So these were thoughts that were happening. But then I thought, oh, I have a good life. I continued. I love surfing. So I was surfing a lot of places in the world. But then I actually got really sick from the Amazon rainforest. I got a disease called dengue, which is a tropical disease, kind of like malaria. And I got really sick. From that moment, my life went very downhill. My girlfriend dumped me. I didn't have much money because I was traveling all the time. Yeah, I was pretty much broke. And I had to move back in to my parents in Belgium. So I was really in a tough situation. But from that difficult moment in my life, I said, you know what? What am I even doing here? You start asking deeper questions. I realized that I'm here on this planet to make sure that future generations can still live here. That's my ultimate goal. Then I started thinking further, how can I start doing that? I discovered that the one way the world has changed is through entrepreneurship, through people like you and me and some of the listeners out there creating a business. Those are the people that are changing the world. So I said, I have to start my own business. So I did. And this is fast forward 5 years ago. Even when from that early experience as a child in my garden, I always wanted to understand how nature works. Because if you understand how nature works, you can use that knowledge to your own advantage and become a better developer, become a better real estate agent, and start creating beautiful projects that work with nature and not against it, and actually create a lot of value, which we can talk more about. So that's in a nutshell what I've been working on, or that's in a nutshell my backstory.
That is amazing. You just said a lot of super interesting things that I would love to unpack. And, you know, what I said in the beginning, I said it obviously as a joke, but it's true. I mean, it is super true. I mean, I'm guilty of cutting out the landscaping budget, or, you know, maybe not cutting it out completely, but shrinking it down to the bare minimum.
Oh, yeah.
Before I get into the real estate development and what landscaping means and what you could offer to developers out there, explain to me, what is an eco farm and sustainable gardening? What does that all mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I have my own podcast, which is called the Regenerative Design Podcast. I invite a lot of guests in different areas that are working in this field. If you look at regenerative, we can look at another word that is more commonly used, which is sustainability. Since the 90s, 2000s, people say, oh, we have to be sustainable because of the climate. If you look at the definition of sustainability, it means to sustain, which is to keep doing the same thing. The paradigm that I see around sustainability is often like, oh, let's keep doing what we're doing, but let's do it a little less harmful for the environment. And that's a very toxic paradigm or mindset to think like, oh, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing and less harmful. Like, that doesn't work. We need something completely different. Regenerative design comes in really handy because now not just going to do it a little bit less harmful, we're actually going to leverage nature to our advantage and do it really well for the environment. And that is actually going to create better businesses. So if you then, and you can apply it on pretty much anything that's outdoors, that's actually what my book is about. That's won an award as well, 12 Universal Laws of Nature, how to get the most potential out of your land. And so I dive into like how nature works, and there's 12 laws. If you want, we can look in that and get really technical. But nature works in a certain way, and then working with nature is really the way forward. And that's, I would say, what regenerative design is. And if we bring it to a, for example, to a farm, it's okay. We can actually produce food that is healthy, that is bring the health of the soil, and that is improving the financial viability of a farm. So it's kind of like we have a bunch of problems in farming, which is chemicals. Farms are with climate change, it's becoming really hard for farmers to produce food. The soils are depleting, bunch of even economical issues. Farmers are committing high, it's like a really high suicide rate in farming. So let's just completely turn that around and start working with nature and become financially strong, because that's part of the equation of regenerative businesses. We have to be financially stronger than what conventional ways of doing. And that knowledge I'm also bringing into garden design. I've done that in the past 5 years. And now more recently, we're also working in big scale developments, because now we can really start playing on a bigger scale. It's kind of like we can play with the big boys and start having real big impact. And if you apply it on a development, we start from pretty much from the first initial idea, which is, okay, we have a lot of land and we want to obviously make profit. We want to develop it and we want to do something good for the community. That's usually what we hear a lot. So then we go into the nitty-gritty of, okay, first we start analyzing the land, what available resources are there. Can we also question common things that are being done in development that is like, why are we even doing that? Is there a better way? For example, a lot of projects, when they start, they bulldoze the whole land and they remove all the soil, which is a massive cost, especially on bigger projects. And that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. We can find more creative ways of working with the land, with the nature. In some cases, projects can take up to 10 years, 20 years to completion. Now, can we already start developing at a lower cost today, developing some natural elements, even small parks, all those things? So by the time that the houses are finished, you actually have a full-grown natural environment that the users can use. So there's a bunch of stuff that we can do to improve the way developments are done.
Okay, let me be blunt.
Yes.
Most developers out there, when they're looking at their projects, they would listen to something like this and they say, all right, look, I don't really care about your tree-hugging bullshit. I'm doing this to make money. And yes, if I can buy sustainable green stuff and it still makes me money, great. But if I have to do all this crap and just, and it's only going to cost me more money, I don't care. Yeah. I want to know how much this house is going to cost. I want to know how much this apartment building is going to cost. Fine, you want landscape and I'll plant some trees, put the grass on, and we're done. Why do I care? Why do I need to care about being sustainable and about, you know, spending too much time, energy, and potentially a lot of money on landscaping? Sorry, I don't mean to be, sound rude. I'm bringing a perspective that I hear all the time. Hell, I've been guilty of it myself many times.
No. I think, first of all, if I would come across, I don't want to be mean either, but if someone comes in with that kind of, I have to be careful, but if someone comes in with that kind of attitude, then probably it's not an ideal client. I would still try and like, hey, let's talk about it. I work with a lot of impact investors and people that are not just, they don't just want to build. They've had massive success. Their bank accounts are full of money. They can get 10 to 15% returns on their investments anywhere, but they kind of like, shit, I'm not actually doing something good for the world. And that's kind of where we come in and we do what's called impact investing. And we will still target high returns. In some cases, I believe over time, we will actually beat the regular investments that are being done. So we need to work with people that are like, I've seen it all. Now I actually want to create something that I can leave behind, that I can be truly proud of. Build in a way that is very exploitive, then be my guest. That's not my job. But if you're like, yeah, I want to really build something unique and also be profitable, then we can talk. But if the case would be like, yeah, I think still that is all total bull crap, then I would go and run them through the numbers and look at like, show me a project and let's look at how you've been doing projects in the past. Show me like the big cost positions, trucking soil around, using certain materials. I just came off, I interviewed someone for my podcast who is building modular homes that are extremely resourceful with the materials they use, because the cost of building in North America in general is very high because people are extremely unresourceful with their materials. They like, there's not a good planning system. Like, architects may make a certain plan for a project, but then the builders have to oftentimes figure stuff out. The wood that they use, they have to cut it up. So lose a lot of the wood in the system that we're using. We're becoming way more resourceful and we're actually building houses based on the materials and not the other way around. So there's a bunch of ways that we can be more resourceful, which then in terms means we can actually allocate some more budget to other things that will improve the quality of living as well. There's also a bunch of plastics and toxics that are being used in construction just because they are cheap. But now if we are more resourceful, we can actually get rid of those and build a project that is as expensive as the conventional ways. But now we can show like, hey, there's no toxins. It's better. It's energy. The insulation is energy. It's more energy efficient. So this is on the construction side and also on the planning side. Who wouldn't like to live in a beautiful environment and who isn't ready to actually pay more for that? As it's already proven that communities that have adequate greenery, which is not just a tree and grass, but actual high value nature that even attracts wildlife to a certain degree, they sell for double the amount in many cases. So yeah, I think we have to obviously work with people that their horizons are a little bit longer than short term. That's the kind of answer that I would give to that. Yeah.
Can you give me an example of where right planning, a proper approach, good approach to landscaping, good approach to building planning actually helped out and in the end generated better
Yeah, so because I'm only 5 years in business, it's really hard to show the hard numbers, but I've been researching it quite a lot, and I've came across some research papers that were studying it, and specifically in the US, they looked at two communities that were in the same region. They were next to each other, and they had the same access to roads, to schools, amenities, everything pretty much outside of the communities were the same. But inside the communities, one, and the plot sizes inside the community were also the same. The only difference was that the one community decided to double down on creating something more beautiful. They put more effort in some details, which might sound that it's more costly, and it is to a certain extent, but it's minimal compared to the long-term gains. So they added some more high-quality greens, so more biodiversity. The other one did what everyone else is doing, which is just putting grass and a couple trees and some shrubs, which you may think, okay, maybe that's enough. But now over the course of the next 20 years, those properties with high quality greenery doubled in value. So if you're into investing and you want to even invest for yourself long-term or for the next generation, make it like, think about it twice before you just go and say, oh, we need to do it quick and as cheap as possible. And again, I have nothing against that, but it's just it's kind of a logical choice.
Absolutely. I was just recently visiting a house, the family, we built a house for them a few years ago, and it had pretty expansive yard and garden, a lot of things going on there. And it was amazing to see just a couple of years later, well, it's been about 3 or 4 years now since we finished, how a lot of the plants that were planted when we just finished construction are now triple the size, and how that garden feels so much more complete now. And I can only imagine that as time passes, it's going to get even more luscious than it was.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty of investing in nature. You do it once and it keeps on giving and it becomes more beautiful over time.
I like what you said too about stripping away all the topsoil. When we start a project, it is very common. We cut all the plants, we strip all the soil, we haul it away, then we finish the building, and then we bring truckloads of new topsoil, and then we plant landscaping in that. But the cost of stripping all the dirt away, then trucking it, then recycling it, then buying it again, then trucking it over again, it's an incredible amount of money that we end up paying.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't make any sense. And the industry will tell you like, oh, that soil that was there before is bad soil, and the new soil that they bring in is good soil. But it's not even true, because when you're doing so much soil disturbance, it's very unnatural. Like if you look in nature, that hardly ever happens, only when there's a landslide or something. And that's what I cover in my book, is that when you disturb the soil so drastically, Mother Nature is very resilient and it has developed a system to do regeneration on its own. We try to speed up the process of regeneration because we want to get to the beautiful flowers or trees. And so we want to speed it up, and there's ways to do that. But if you just have a lot of soil disturbance, the first plants that Mother Nature sends in to restore the health of the soil are weeds. So the stuff that we hate in our gardens, and they're not actually, their weed is just a nasty word for an annual plant that is also very difficult to get rid of because the soil is so disturbed. You might be building this beautiful development, putting in the new soil, putting even plants, quickly putting them in the soil because we want to sell fast, which is also okay. But then the homeowner might buy it, or by the time it's you start having weeds everywhere, and it becomes really expensive to maintain it as well. And that's another thing that very few people in my industry are there to talk about, is the maintenance of a garden. You might have been thinking like, oh, it all sounds nice, but now I have to maintain it. Well, if you do it the conventional way, you have to pay a lot of money to maintain it. And there's a lot of companies that make really good money, but they're doing stuff that is actually making the maintenance, they increase the maintenance. And I joke about it with my friend. I was visiting him in Canada, and he's in a community. And so you have these bigger companies that come in and do the maintenance for all the gardens. And I looked at them and I joked and I said, like, this guy is actually doing maintenance to increase the maintenance, because they have no clue. They come in with a blower, they clean it up, they remove some weeds, and they're actually making the problem worse, which is also kind of, and it's just how things have evolved. But we have to question that, like, why do you spend, as a bigger community, why do you spend tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands a year for the maintenance of your property, like go into nature and look there. Is there maintenance in nature? Have you seen someone maintaining a natural environment? No. So why can't we apply that knowledge in communities? Not to even talk about the huge amounts of chemicals that are being used to maintain lawns.
This is my favorite.
Like you're spraying toxic stuff in your yards, and then your kids are playing, I want to say soccer, but for you, it's American football and baseball. You're rolling in the grass in poison. And then you wonder why there's so much cancer and diabetes and all the modern diseases in the Western world.
Hey, my kids play soccer too. World.
What is that?
I said, my kids play soccer too.
Nice.
Well, hey.
Oh, yeah.
So, hey, this is, you touched on something that was really annoying for me a couple of years ago. We were working on a new project and we were proposing to plant what the city described, or the city actually required us to plant native vegetation, meaning all the plants that are native for this region. And it was cool. You know, we obviously wanted to be as compliant on the one hand, but also to do as much good as possible for the environment. So it makes no sense bringing in species that are not native to the region. So we said, okay, that's fine. We agreed to plant all the native species. Our designer provided several different plants or specified different plants. But then one of the requirements from the city was to put in the irrigation. And we're like, wait a second, I don't understand. If these plants are native, that means they grow in this environment naturally. Why do you need to water them? I mean, okay, I understand when you first plant them, you probably need to give them a little extra water. But then once they establish, don't they just grow on their own?
Yeah.
And we could never win this battle. They're like, well, this is the requirement. You need to provide irrigation. You need to water them.
Oh, wow. That's wild. Yeah, what we do with new plantations is we will set up temporary irrigation systems that are also strongly monitored because it's very wasteful to water your plants all the time. In fact, when you use the conventional irrigation system, it'll be constantly drip, 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 dripping on the soil. And that actually makes plants extremely lazy because the humidity stays on the top of the layer. So they don't make deep roots. You make lazy plants. So you have to continuously keep watering your plants. Whereas if you just shift to a different mode, what we do is we water not a lot, but if we water a lot. Like, let's put it that way. The frequency is low, but if we give water, then we give it a lot of water. So it goes deep into the soil and then the plants will naturally make deeper roots. So over time, we can get rid of the irrigation system. Again, there's massive ways to optimize and to cut costs and be more regenerative because I'm a big opponent of whatever we do, it has to be more competitive because it's good for the environment and for the future of our planet. But separate from that, it has to be more profitable. Like otherwise, it's not sustainable.
Right. And if it makes financial sense and it also works for the environment, then why not do both?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Matthew, another thing. You mentioned earlier about working with nature, not against nature. And this comes up a lot in my business. We have had a lot of projects in what we call difficult areas, critical areas, such as wetlands and steep slopes. And right now I'm working on a project that's partially in the floodplain. It's right by the river. And then it's partially, it has part of the property has wetlands. What advice would you give to somebody? And there's so many properties, especially in our urban areas that are very dense, that it seems like the only land that's available to be developed is in some sort of a complicated, difficult state. What advice would you give for somebody trying to work with properties that has a lot of these environmental issues?
That's a great question. I think in a first step, we should maybe question if we should be building at all in those places because floodplains, they're very natural and it's going to increase because now with climate change, you might have a long dry period. The river runs dry, all of a sudden, flash flood, and then the river bursts out of its normal course. So I think in a bigger scale, but this has to be state-wise or national-wise, is we need planning and we need to allow rivers to be able to go outside of their normal form and even plan it in a way so when it happens, it only happens in a certain area that can even become a beautiful nature reserve so that it doesn't affect the houses. And that can be done with some engineering systems, very low profile, but that's obviously a municipality or state or national, but definitely has to be looked into. Like even in Belgium, there's a lot of projects that the government is going to start buying farmland so that we can use that as a way that when it rains a lot, those areas will be put underwater and it will actually create a beautiful habitat for birds and wildlife. So, and it can still be used even for some farming, but it's more like a nature reserve. So that's a first thing. And then when you actually then have the areas that are still, it really is project-based. We have to analyze like what is the slopes, what is the landscape, what is the structure of the soil. Can we build even a little bit, can we put the construction a little bit higher on stilts, for example? Can we landscape, change the landscape so in case there's floods, we can mitigate it? And another big thing is that we have to make sure that our soils are as water absorbed, like we have to make sure that the soil can absorb as much water as possible. So in doing that, we can put in what they call dry gardens or rain gardens, which is pretty much just like in your garden, you will build a soil that is very drainant by adding rocks or materials that are very easy to drain, so that when there's a flash flood, it'll run into that area. And maybe it's only going to flood a certain area of your garden. Being really smart about the design and thinking about, okay, what if there's too much water, where will it go so it doesn't go into the houses? And that's a big one. And then obviously the biggest reason why there is problems with flooding is that we build all these roads for new housing, which are asphalted. And that's a lot of surface that if it rains, the water cannot infiltrate there. So even in municipal grounds, we have to find ways to take that water and infiltrate it locally in that certain area. So again, adding small pocket park, if I would design a bigger community project in the lower areas, I would, for example, build a semi-public park that can be used for skating or for other activities for the community, that when the flash flood comes, we know like this area, we can put it underwater safely and all the houses are protected. So it really comes down to analyzing the bigger environment of looking at maps and floodplains and all those bigger informations to then, okay, what happens if our property gets underwater? How can we direct the water to certain areas that are not going to affect the housing?
Amazing. Great advice. Matthew, the question that I ask everybody, tell the listeners about sort of your biggest professional mistake that you've ever made that taught you the biggest lesson.
Oh, I love this question. I think hiring a client where I had a gut feeling that it's not a good match, but I was smelling the money, as we would say in Dutch. I don't know if you say that in English.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, I don't feel a connection with the client. He is a billionaire. I actually enjoyed working with him because the project ended up being something really cool. But I had a gut feeling that it wasn't going to be good. And still, I followed the money. It ended up in a big lawsuit because what happened is we completely a city garden in the center of Frankfurt in Germany. After we finished the garden, there was a problem of water in the basement. And so the owner's like, hey, you guys, you changed my garden. It's your fault. And it wasn't our fault because there was a construction company that came before us that was demolishing the foundations of the basement because there was a project. But it ended in a massive lawsuit, which took 2.5 years and drained me energetically and financially, because that guy had a lot of money and he wanted to just drain us to get us to court so we would bend to his will. Luckily, I found, and I'm so grateful for that, I found a really good lawyer who helped me through it, and we won the court case eventually. But I guess not following your gut is one of the biggest mistakes.
Not following your gut is one of the biggest mistakes. I would tend to agree. Follow your gut and trust the relationship. I always say, if you don't have a good feeling about a person, about a company that you're working with, it's better to stay clear. It doesn't matter how much the deal is promising to pay you. Every single time you're going to run into issues. And especially in real estate and construction development, issues come up all the time. And so if you don't have that good rapport, that good relationship from the very beginning, it's a recipe for disaster. It's going to end up in a lawsuit and it's going to end up in huge losses.
Yeah, I agree.
Matthew, this was super valuable. What I learned is that sustainable construction, sustainable development doesn't have to be necessarily expensive. It could also provide good return on investment. You may need to wait a little bit longer to see it realized, but it should provide good return on investment and also do good to the environment. You should always work with the nature when you're designing a project and not try to divert the rivers. I'm putting words in your mouth right now. You didn't say that, but that's what I took away from it, that we should always try to add as much greenery and landscape and nature to our brick and mortar buildings, because that's what brings us closer to the nature. And in the end, it makes the project and the product look so much more appealing to the end consumer that it will have to pay dividends. And again, you might need to wait a little bit longer for that garden to grow, but when it does, that project is going to do so much better than another project that didn't have that. And of course, the key is smart design has to consider future maintenance, whether it's landscaping or anything else for that matter. You could potentially save a buck at the front end, but then lose a ton over time by overspending on maintenance. And landscaping is a key example. I've seen it so many times, and I think it's super valuable advice. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Eugene, for having me. You asked some really cool questions.
I appreciate it. And we'll have your contact information and show notes. Please reach out to Matthew. He is an awesome designer, a great guy. And if nothing else, you'll enjoy the conversation and definitely check out his book and his podcast. Thank you. And if this conversation gave you new clarity or tools to move forward in your development journey, the best way to say thanks is to subscribe and leave a great review that helps more people like you find the show and join the conversation. Thanks for being part of Real Estate Development Land to Legacy.